This is 2.1, a Netrunner Reboot Project podcast. Episode 111, Panic is Expensive. Hey, this is Remy. The title card of this week's episode is Calling Card, a new criminal card from the upcoming booster, with the flavor text, Surprise is cheap, panic is expensive. And yes, I am back a little earlier than I originally anticipated or said that I would be. I do expect my next regular episode to be on January 10th, hopefully. But in view of the fact that we had Winter Worlds and the release of the new booster and some new patch notes, I thought that, well, I could still get together a relatively short episode and cover all of that stuff rather than wedge it into an episode that's probably going to be pretty long anyway. So that's what this episode is. Let's do it. Precognition, the sixth booster for Reboot, and some patch notes. So the sixth booster is New Normal. That's the name of it. And I don't know if that's maybe just like a commentary on the fact that this is the new normal kind of booster that we're going to see, or what exactly. But as I've said before, as has been announced before, the boosters have been previously 30 card packs, and now they're going to be 8 card packs, but perhaps coming out rather than every 9 to 12 months, maybe more like every 6 months. So these cards were spoiled. I'm going to cover them in the order in which they were spoiled, rather than their pack release order. They started being spoiled on the day of Worlds, actually right after the Swiss part of the Worlds was completed on December 14th. And again, there are 8 of them. They have got the it has gone live, so these are available to play with in the game. But I'm just going to run through them here. I'm not going to have any commentary. That's my typical pattern when it comes to covering stuff that I haven't incorporated into the main card pool yet. The Jinteki card is Zero Waste AgriFineries, a 4-2 agenda. When your turn begins, you may make each player draw one card. The first time the runner draws a card each turn, gain one credit. So that's a nice way to get yourself a credit for free each turn at the cost. That's a relatively small cost, right, of giving the runner a card. The criminal card is our title card, Calling Card. A resource with an install cost of 1 and 1 influence. You place 3 power counters on it when you install it, and you choose a server when you install it. When your turn begins, remove a power counter. Once you've gone down to 0, then you run the chosen server. And at the end of that run, if it is successful, you gain 6 credits, and then Calling Card is trashed. So essentially, it's a install for 1, and then gain 6 credits and a run. Dirty Laundry is a 2-cost event that gives you 5 credits and a run. So this is double the money, although it is a bit of a delay, and of course you're giving the corp a chance to compensate for that. The Wayland card I like. Bowstring is the name. It is a code gate in Wayland. The res cost is 3. The strength is 3. It's also 3 influence. Here's the special ability on it. You may trash Bowstring instead of paying an additional cost of forfeiting an agenda. So you see, it pairs well with Archer. It also has a subroutine that says end the run unless the runner pays 3 credits. The neutral card is a corp card, Crunch Time, an operation that costs zero but is one influence and lets you search R&D or archives for a piece of ice with a res cost of six or less, and then you reveal it and put it in your hand. The Anarch card is Lab Rat, a resource with an install cost of two, three influence. You put five power counters on it when you install it, and when there are none, you trash it, as is true with Calling Card. Well, not exactly with Calling Card. Calling Card does get trashed at the end of that run, though. As with Calling Card, when your turn begins, you remove a power counter, but you also gain two credits. So essentially, you're going to gain 10 credits off of this resource. However, your maximum hand size is minus one for every power counter that is on it. So when you first install it, your maximum hand size is dropped all the way down to zero. Haas Bioroid gets CeraVue campaign. At least that's how I think it's pronounced. CereVue. It is an advertisement asset, the res cost of one and trash cost of two and two influence. And when your turn ends, you gain two credits if you did not gain any credits from card abilities this turn. It's interesting, right? When your turn ends, not begins. It's a campaign, though. But it's not a campaign that Engineering the Future is going to want, because ETF is always gaining credits from its card from a card ability, the ability printed on its identity card. This continues the big boy's approach of trying to give Haas Bioroid cards that don't automatically slot into ETF. The Shaper card is By Popular Demand, a terminal run event. It costs one, it's two influence. And here's what it says. Make a run, make a run, make a run, make a run. So you make four runs on the end of your turn, but you can't use it with something like Apocalypse or Notoriety because it's a terminal event. However, it does work with things like Medium, for example. And the final card is the NBN card, Doublespeak, an illicit barrier. Remember, that means that you're going to take a bad publicity when you res it. The res cost is three, the strength is four, it's four influence, and subroutines on this barrier cannot be broken if there is no installed decoder. So it really forces both a decoder and a barrier. Now, it doesn't do anything nasty, it's just an end the run. In fact, it's a trace to end the run. The subroutine is a trace six, but that's still pretty chunky. A pretty chunky end the run that's going to force the runner to have two breakers installed to be able to break through it. All right, again, so those are the eight cards that are part of the sixth booster for Reboot, New Normal. But while we're here, let's also cover the patch notes. Doublespeak was revealed on the 21st, and the patch notes are dated the 22nd. And I think this is the first time this is true. There are no nerfs in this patch. They're all buffs. They're also all two booster cards, and they are all original booster cards, so none that have been imported. The first of these is from the second booster, Mind and Mayhem. We'll be talking about this card in the next episode. It's Caterpillar, a flippable Jinteki ice that goes from being mythic to being a barrier, and then the flip happens. There's a power counter countdown, kind of like on these two new cards for Anarch and Criminal. The buff is that its strength has been increased from one to two. The comment from the big boy: Caterpillar takes so much work and patience already that having it also die to parasite trivially is just a bummer. A couple of Anarch cards that are in Mind and Mayhem as well. The first one is Painapple, although the first A in Painapple is a four and the E is a three. It is hardware, and you can basically take a brain damage and lose the hardware in order to trash cheap ice. The cost has been reduced from 1 to 0. Big Boy says, P4's effect was a lot stronger when it was printed because next ice was extremely common. Now that this is no longer the case, the card can use a buff. Also, Glee, the console for Anarch in Mind and Mayhem, gives you a memory unit, and you gain a credit whenever a corp card is trashed during a run on a central. The cost has been reduced now from 3 to 2. For a value over time console, Glee almost never gets chosen over Vigil or Grimoire. Now it's easier to install early, which should help its payoff curve a ton. The next couple of buffs are out of the fourth booster, Equity and Eternity. The first is Dark Pool, a Wayland Codegate. It has an extra strength for every 10 credits the corp has, and the subroutines are search R&D for a transaction operation and play it, and end the run if the corp has at least 20 credits. The cost has been reduced from 4 to 3. It's been buffed once before. I believe originally the subroutine was that the corp would have to have at least 25 credits to trigger the ETR. Now the cost has been reduced, the res. Dark Pool has been getting a lot of hate, probably more than it deserves. I'm wary of good Wayland code gates with face check punishment, since pre-installing a decoder against Wayland feels really awful. But Dark Pool is so narrow that it can afford to be a little better. Also from Equity and Eternity, Hype, a flippable shaper program, the backside is Hope, but the buff is to the front side. When an agenda is stolen, you trash Hype, draw 3 cards, and gain 4 credits. Well, now that credit gain has been bumped to 5. The Big Boy says players are almost universally preferring Nyashia to Hype Hope, even in Sonya. Sonya is the identity in the fourth pack that does things with installing things out of the trash, and the Hope side comes into play when you install it out of the trash. This buff to the differentiating aspect of Hype will hopefully make this choice closer. And the final 3 buffs are from the previous pack, Fate and Freedom. The first is Communalink Rollout, an NBN 3-2 agenda that gives the runner a maximum hand size of plus one. And if they're tagged, the corpse max hand size goes up by 2. Well, now that's been changed to be at +3. The Big Boy says, it's a lot of work to stick a tag, and then it takes even more time for the max hand size payoff to matter. On a 3-2, this ability doesn't have to do a ton, but it can afford to do a bit more than it does now. Project Genesis is a flippable Jinteki asset. When you res it, you put 3 power counters on it, and again, the power counters count down to flip. And when you flip and install it, the backside is, there's 3 different possibilities, an asset, an upgrade, or an ice, and you make that decision before the game. But the trash cost of the asset has been 2, now been buffed to 3. The payoffs for Project Genesis feel strong enough, but it's too easy for the runner to disrupt, both installed and in HQ, so a trash cost buff should help it feel more reliable. And then we have Kaede Ueno, a Jinteki asset that when the runner accesses it from R&D or when it's installed, but not when it's in HQ, you do a net damage. But then when your turn begins, you add it to HQ and gain 2 credits. The trash cost has been bumped from 1 to 3. Kaede is supposed to be a key support card for Gandiva. That's the Jinteki identity in that pack. And neither is strong enough yet. This buff should make you feel way happier about tricking the runner into running your bait card, because it's going to cost him 3 to trash it. So those are your set of buffs for the December 22nd patch notes. Experiential data. Winter Worlds 2025. Well, I don't think we had a summer or fall worlds this year. It was supposed to be a seasonal thing. Like every season, there's supposed to be a worlds. And I guess life just got in the way for people. We had the spring champs. Now we have the winter champs. It happened on December 14th. There were 12 players. So this was a live tournament as opposed to the constructed league and the pre-constructed league, which are asymmetric time-wise. There were four rounds, and then there was a cut to the top four. The top of the Swiss was Gamonet on 18 points. That would be six wins out of eight games. Went undefeated as the Corp and then split his runner games, two and two. Same number of points. The second seed was Dunch 97, who went 3-1 with both Corp and runner, but had a lower strength of schedule. R2 Devo, V Slice, and Puffin Zero all had 15 points. They split with one side, 2-2, and went 3-1 with the other. But strength of schedule makes the difference, and so Puffin Zero missed out on the cut for that reason. Now, I actually finished 7th in this tournament with 12 points. I went 2-2 with both my Corp and my runner, although my last game, I came one credit short of being able to steal the winning agenda. And if I'd gotten that, then I would have been at 5th overall and lost out because of a lower strength of schedule. So the top four, V-Slice played Gamonet and swept. So the four seed took down the one seed there. And then between Dunch and R2 Devo, the way this works in the cut in Reboot is you play two games, and if you split, you play a third game of the higher seed's choice. So in this case, Dunch won that third game. They then played one game of their finals, which V-Slice won, but had to delay the second one because of time zone considerations. I think V-Slice is on the West Coast, U.S., and Dunch is in Central Europe, so they are really far apart time-wise. But once they finally got together again, V-Slice won that second game as well, becoming the Winter Worlds champ. There are a couple of streams that you can watch. Manta streamed his games, and Goblin Mode streamed his and most of the cut with some commentary that he and Zaylee got on to do for those games in the cut. I also have a list. I'll put it in, where am I going to put this? I guess I'll link it in the show notes. To all of the decks, well, at this point I have almost all of the decks for the 12 players. Lee didn't submit a deck before I recorded this. He finished in 12th with Professor and ETF. And then actually the champ, V-Slice, it hasn't posted his noise deck yet. But everybody else posted their deck, either actually published it on NRDB, on RetechyDB, or they linked to their private version of the deck. And I did, of course, a big write-up for my deck, and, why don't I just go ahead and read it? Come this far. By the way, it was It was a Cybernetics Division deck, which is the one that both hands start with one hand size of -1. Here is what I said. I seem to have a pathological aversion to playing good decks. I don't know why. But when I win with a known good deck, like a pre-constructed deck, for example, I don't feel like I won. I feel like the deck won. I do feel, however, that if the game is lost, it was definitely something I did wrong, rather than there being a problem with the deck. So maybe I just want to play a bad deck so I can blame the deck for losing, rather than myself. Enough psychoanalysis. I came across the deck Xanatos Gambit while researching Cybernetics Division for my podcast back in the spring when the 2.1 group reached Chrome City. The concept for that deck is pretty simple. Quoting from Tie-Dyed Vortex's write-up, you play Mushin No Shin on either Cerebral Overrider or Mandatory Upgrades. This leads to four outcomes, all of which are favorable. One, it's an overwriter, and they run it. With your ID ability, this gives them a one-card hand for the rest of the game. Two, it's an overwriter, and they leave it alone. You now have the world's most secure server for your shell corporation. Three, it's a mandatory upgrades, and they leave it alone. You score and immediately begin fast advancing like there's no tomorrow, occasionally dropping and using Melange Mining Corp in the same turn for crazy amounts of money. Four, it's a mandatory upgrades, and they run it. You play a media blitz and start fast advancing anyway. Unquote. See, now, this is what I'm talking about. This is fun to me. At the time, since we only had Chrome City, the media blitz play wasn't an option. That lets you copy the other player's agenda in the other player's score area. Taking inspiration from another commenter somewhere, or maybe this was just my idea because new CybDiv has so much influence and I didn't have media blitz, I swapped out all the next dice for the Grail Suite, generating my deck But Brain downgraded. I also wanted to see how self-destruct chips and Gyri Labyrinth would play in this shell. Answer? Not so well. According to Riteki, this deck has only one win in seven games. Though this does include at least a couple of games after we introduced Old Hollywood into the pool and I had a chance to use back channels. Once Data and Destiny arrived in the pool, I was able to shift into a closer clone of the Xanatos Gambit deck, using the next suite of ice rather than the Grail suite and shifting that influence into Media Blitz and Shipment from Sansan? Okay, well, that didn't work so well either. I mean, don't get me wrong, motioning a man-ups that gets stolen and then playing a Media Blitz to get the extra click anyway is pretty awesome. But as we can all see, that is a three-card combo, and that is probably not something that makes for a consistent deck. With the extra tools and reflections, I made a few changes. One was making room for an IPO. Being poor is a consistent issue for this deck, partly due to relying so heavily on Mushin plus Untouched Overrider plus Shell Corporation, or Back Channels, another three-card combo, partly due to hoping to get a man-ups and then use Melange, and partly due to the Mushin nerf now costing so much money, especially early. Another change was bringing in a next-level clearance, which did help me close out one of my wins in this iteration of the deck. This deck did twice as well as the original version, and I got two wins in seven games. Progress. Moving into Mind and Mayhem, I wanted to appropriate some of the tools for Echo Mem Vaults, especially microtransactions and Vulcan 1.0 Mind Maze. Well, again, we'll talk about these in the next episode. I dumped the Melanges, which almost never worked anyway, and the special offer I'd tried out for microtransactions and a second IPO. The Architects made way for the Vulcans in a straight swap. I didn't have a chance to play this version prior to Worlds, but as I was going back to the original Xanatos Gambit list to see if I'd made too many changes and drifted too far from the original premise, I noticed an open tab that's been sitting there for months, probably. It was for a deck derived from Xanatos that went in a slightly different direction, and it looked good to me after all of my experience with the deck so far. Yes, for me, 14 games is a lot of experience with a deck. This one is called Mindless Mind, and the deck's author is quite verbose, almost as much as me, so I won't reiterate everything said in the write-up there, but the key insight that helped me unlock more performance in the deck was to embrace simple IAA. That, of course, is Install, Advance, Advance. Out went the Shell Corporation in favor of another back channels. In fact, out went the Archived Memories, since IAA-ing Vitruvius is easier. And the Media Blitzes, the logic being that agendas get stolen too frequently to make them worth it. To make room for a Neural EMP, and the June bugs that make IAA-ing more valuable. I also made a couple of smaller ice changes, pulling an Eli for a Heimdall so I could have a big taxing barrier, and more brain damage subs, swapping out Touring for Victor 1 and dipping my toe forward into Equity and Eternity by replacing Special Offer with Fairchild to regain influence and for even more brain damage subs. These changes really help the deck, as far as I can tell. It's still a little poor, especially if you don't see back channels, but if you do, it's pretty easy to get large influxes of money at the simple cost of IAAing a trap or an agenda, especially thanks to the back channels buff. Mushin makes it even better, with back channels buff offsetting the Mushin nerf. But even if back channels doesn't appear, shifting fully into operation economy puts things on a more solid footing. As I already said, I could never get Melange to pull its weight, not to mention all the times it just got trashed straight out of R&D. And as much fun as Media Blitz on man-ups is, and even though it is an operation, as a current, it is probably too delicate. I do think that the deck could still use more money, especially since so much of the econ of the deck is sunk into just three cards. Would one of the other clearances be a good addition? Maybe? I don't know what I'd cut, and I'm not really sure I want or need the extra draw. Perhaps the answer is that I don't need as much ice as I have. I freely admit that I don't really have a solid grasp of how best to put together a full ice suite beyond just about the same number of each type, which this deck very much does not have. I will say that this post by the big boy that I quoted a couple episodes back was very useful to me, and some of the changes I made here were guided by it. But is 14 the right number? Should I actually have 15? Could I get by with less? No clue. Aside from the economy aspect, the other thing that seems to happen a lot when playing the deck is bleeding agendas. This was exacerbated on the day by Refragmenter, a card outside of the current 2.1 card pool and therefore one I'd never played against before. I don't usually go in for conspiracy theories, but for as many times as I've been agenda flooded with this deck, it makes me wonder whether there's some flag in the JNAC code that is set to auto-lose when playing with Cybdiv. Though it's more likely that I'm just really bad at managing where the agendas are, it was still tough for 6 of my agendas to appear in the top 16 cards of my deck in one of my losses on Sunday. Although this was counterbalanced somewhat by one of my runner wins, where I went from 2 points to 8 on my final desperation turn by pulling 3 straight posted bounties off of R&D. Oh, so how about a quick actual tournament report? I got smoked by Dunch in round 1, flooded hard against Goblin Mode in round 2, then turned it around and won against Lee in round 3 after he ran into an IAA'd Overrider turn 1 and was on 0. Hand size for a lot of the game, although I couldn't find that neural EMP. And capped it off in round 4 with a win against Flak Maniac off the IAA'd Junebug. In one of those two last games, I actually scored 2 man-ups. So 2-2 on the day, after previous versions of the deck had gone only 3-11. Small sample size, obviously, but it definitely felt a lot better. And a lot of that was down to the approach of being willing to naked install advance rather than wait for the hammer blow of Mushin. So I'm looking forward to playing that again when I can get back into my regular Netrunner nights once work maybe is a little nicer to me. We'll see. Anyway, many of the cards discussed in this week's episode are linked in the show notes. Music is from Alexi Action. The website that redirects to the Reboot Project homepage is netrunner2.1.com. On that site, you can actually see the patch notes, and not just the most recent one, but you can go back and look at all the patch notes. That's actually a big resource I have, ever since the boosters anyway, have started. That's one of the resources I use when putting together my episodes and talking about how the boosters have changed. Of course, on the Discord server, you can get into a lot of conversation. You can play online at retechie.fun. I'm going to go ahead and do an AstroScript pilot program this time around. That doesn't take a lot of prep time and effort. We're going to move into the second part of the section on Mars. This one is about Martian terraforming. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Mars has been a desolate wasteland for billions of years. Outside the domes, exposure to the thin atmosphere without the aid of specialized envirosuits means a slow and agonizing death. Daily temperatures are brutally cold, except at the equator, and the planet's lack of a magnetosphere means that solar radiation impacts the surface unimpeded. Compared to the environment the first settlers encountered, however, the efforts to make Mars a friendlier setting for human life have been a resounding success. Or, so the corps claim. Even so, many centuries of work remain before a genetically unmodified human can walk on the surface of Mars without assistance or protection. If Mars is to become habitable outside of the colony domes, three problems need to be addressed. Mars has no breathable atmosphere. The average surface temperatures are far too cold, and the solar wind freely bombards the surface with radiation. For terraforming to be successful, Mars's atmospheric pressure needs to be raised so that water can exist in liquid form outside of a controlled environment. Mars must also be able to keep its atmosphere from escaping into space. Finally, Mars needs a magnetosphere to protect it from the threats of solar radiation. Either greenhouse gas production needs to continue permanently, or a planetary-scale artificial magnetic field must be developed. Rumors abound that research into this is already well underway, but the power realities of such an immense project leave many skeptical, even with solar and fusion technologies. Methods. Much of the colony's structure and development revolves around shaping the Martian atmosphere for human habitation. A sizable part of the Martian economy is directed toward terraforming the planet, including industries such as geothermal mining, agriculture, and transport. Practices that have been banned or restricted on Earth are extensively employed on Mars, such as the purposeful release of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, and other greenhouse gases. Bioseeding and meteor mining comprise the more unusual techniques that Martian terraformers use. Bioseeding. Although still in its earliest stages, bioseeding provides the initial microbial life that will eventually convert carbon dioxide in the Martian atmosphere into oxygen. These bacteria, algae, lichens, and microscopic plants are genetically engineered to withstand the harsh environment and solar radiation of Mars, and they form the foundation for an eventual self-sustaining food chain. Such efforts are virtually invisible to the typical Martian, however, as the only plant life encountered by the general populations is that found in the horticultural domes. However, in a handful of lower altitude locations near the equator, a keen observer might see a greenish tint on areas of the planet's surface, or some heavy reddish lichen clinging to a rock. CFC excavation. Compounds like CFC-12, sulfur hexafluoride, SF6, and others are even more effective than carbon dioxide in retaining atmospheric heat and raising pressure. As such, numerous sulfur mines have cropped up in the Tharsis volcanic region, and fluorine strip mines dot the planet's surface. The work is dangerous, but pays well, attracting large groups of Martian immigrants who work on the frontier for months at a time before heading back to recuperate at the larger colonies. Many of the pioneers frequenting the local watering holes are fitted with cybernetics of varying quality, evidence of one mining accident or another. The demand for the brutal labor won't die down anytime soon, since surplus rare metals are shipped back to Luna or to the Belt at an impressive profit. Meteor mining. Meteor mining is a bit of a misnomer, in that crews are mining for suitable meteoroids to become meteors and eventually meteorites. Prospectors scour the outer edges of the asteroid belt for solid bodies with high concentrations of water, ice, or ammonia. By placing remote-controlled thrusters at specific points on the meteoroid's surface, these comet jockeys alter their plunder's orbit for a precise collision course with designated sites on Mars. As crude and dangerous as this may sound, it remains the most viable means for rapidly altering the Martian atmosphere. Over time, these small meteorites raise the levels of water vapor, oxygen, and nitrogen, bringing Mars a small step closer to achieving breathable air. The space cowboys that work the asteroid belt are an intrepid lot. While ammonia and water-rich comets and asteroids are a major part of their business, the belt is brimming with vast hordes of untapped mineral resources. Women and men seeking a fortune in the glittering expanses procure a ship, often under contracts from the Wayland Consortium or its subsidiaries. Yet few ships remain exclusively tied to one sponsor. Crews might employ bioroids impervious to vacuum or four-armed clones engineered for long-term zero gravity. Legal jurisdiction in these far-flung space locations is blurry at best, and the cutthroat nature of asteroid prospecting makes for dangerous business. But for those willing to take the risk, fortunes await. The sacred surface of Mars. Not only do the corporations oppress the children of Mars, they also defile the sacred surface of humanity's birth planet. These terraforming efforts threaten to disrupt the primordial balance of wind, ice, and rock that sustained our progenitors. Our messiah, Vasanti Smith, has embraced our ancient heritage and reclaimed humanity's sacred birthright. It was only a matter of time until we unlocked the secrets of our own creation. Our DNA remembers, and we can revert to our true forms, that of an ancient people who commanded the red dust and built glorious civilizations. You might not believe it's true, but that's exactly what the corps want you to think. They unearthed our age-old settlements when they began mining here. They're covering it up, afraid of what we'll do if we realize our true natures. Interview with an anonymous Crimson Dust adherent.